All right, thank you. Good afternoon, board members, Lahontan staff, and the public. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Lahontan Regional Water Quality Control Board. My name is Jeff Lux, and I'm the chair, and I'm from Truckee. Today's board meeting is being conducted in person from Apple Valley and via Zoom. AGP Video is hosting our board meeting. At this time, I'd like to introduce the other members of the regional board here today. Rick Deaver from Crestline. Kimberly Cox from Hellendale.
Good afternoon.
And Robert Pierce from Bishop.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you. We have a quorum physically present in the Apple Valley today for today's meeting, and we're ready to go. Our executive staff are here today also in Apple Valley, including our executive officer, Ben Litton, assistant executive officer, Jan Zimmerman, our legal counsel, Elizabeth Barrett, our board clerk, Ariel LaFarga. We will also be joined by other staff members, many of whom are in the audience right now, for individual agenda items. For those who are present and wish to speak on an agenda item, please fill out the orange card in the back of the room and hand it to Ariel LaFarga. In addition, we are receiving presentations and public comments through a Zoom meeting platform. If you intend to present or comment via Zoom, you should have submitted a virtual speaker card to our board clerk, Ariel LaFarga, and be in the Zoom meeting room. If you think you might be interested in commenting via Zoom, please contact our board clerk promptly at ariel.lafarga@waterboards.ca.gov. That's ariel.lafarga@waterboards.ca.gov. For those joining us via Zoom, your camera will be turned off and you'll be muted until it is your turn to speak. When you're done speaking and the board members have completed asking their questions, you'll be placed on mute again. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. With that, we're going to move on to our first item. And the first item is our kind of standard item number one, which is public forum. So any person may address the Water Board regarding a matter within the Water Board's jurisdiction that's not related to an item on the meeting agenda or currently pending before the Water Board. And do we have any speaker cards for this?
We do not.
Okay, not in person or Zoom.
Correct.
Thank you so much. Public forum is completed. That was easy. All right, item two, board meeting minutes. The Water Board will consider adopting the minutes of the regular meeting of March 25th, 2026.
I'll move approval of the item.
Okay. Do we have a second? We don't need it, but do we have one?
Sure, I second.
And I will call a roll vote. Member Cox?
Aye.
Member Deaver?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pierce?
Aye.
Chair Lux?
Aye.
Okay, the motion carries on that one. All right, moving to item three. That's the reports by Water Board members. So the Water Board members provide updates on activities, events, things of interest. And are we going to hear from Board Member Morgan? Do we know?
She should be online yet.
Okay, well, maybe we want to start there. I think it makes some sense. Board Member Morgan, are you with us online?
I am.
Oh, wonderful. Good to see you. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon, Chair Lux and members of the board. It is an honor to be able to join you this afternoon. So a few updates. Just want to remind everyone that the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting will be held on Thursday, May 14th and Friday, May 15th in Sacramento at the Cal EPA headquarters building. The Water Quality Coordinating Committee meetings, which are also known as WQCC, has been held nearly every year by the State and Regional Water Board since Port-au-Clone Water Quality Control Act went into effect in January 1970. This is the one time a year that members of the nine regional water boards and the state water board are able to get together. Let's see, changing subjects over to SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. So the Delta Mendota Groundwater Subbasin at our April 7th board meeting, the State Water Board approved a resolution to return the Delta Mendota Groundwater Subbasin to DWR, the Department of Water Resources jurisdiction under SGMA. And then also at our April 7th board meeting, the State Water Board approved two resolutions excluding certain groundwater extractors from SGMA reporting and fee requirements on the basis that these groundwater pumpers have a minimum impact on groundwater extractions. Pumpers covered under these exclusions are not required to report their extractions or pay fees to the board. So there's two resolutions. The first one being 2026-0011 excludes well owners who extract no more than 20 acre feet of groundwater per year in the Tule subbasin and do not pump groundwater within 2 miles of the Fryant Kern Canal from SGMA reporting fees and reporting. The second is Resolution 2026-0012, which excludes well owners who extract no more than 20 acre feet of groundwater per year in the Tulare subbasin and do not export groundwater outside the subbasin for SGMA reporting and the requirements. Then at our April 21st board meeting, the State Board approved a resolution to deny requests for exclusions for probationary reporting and fees from the following groundwater sustainability agencies in the Tule subbasin and probationary subbasin under SGMA. So these subbasins are the Lower Tule River Irrigation GSA, Dixley Irrigation District GSA, Porterville Irrigation District, South Saloo Irrigation District, Terrabella Irrigation District, Tri-County Water Authority, Teapot Dome Water District, and Vandela Irrigation District. So those, the requests for exclusion and probation error reporting of these were denied. Changing over to Sites Reservoir, this is under ex parte, so just a quick update. I will not be able to answer any questions. The AHO has prepared on behalf of the State Water Board a draft decision and associated draft water right permit on petition for assignment state filed application. Those are out for review. The board will accept written comments on the draft decision and draft permit by the end of day on May 22nd. Also under ex parte is the Delta Conveyance Project. And so the protestant's rebuttal portion of the DCP hearing will begin in June of this year. On April 23rd, staff released a ruling on DWR's objections. And on May 1st, staff released a procedural ruling on evidentiary objections. So let's see here, vapor intrusion workshops. So a series of vapor intrusion workshops have been ongoing. So I've been reporting on those. The fourth in the series is Vapor Intrusion Holistic Approach Part 2, Paths to Closure and Risk Management Decision-Making. This one will be held on May 14th from 9 to 2 p.m. Please note these are all by video and teleconference only. Mono Lake. So at our last State Board workshop on Mono Lake, the State Board directed the staff to come back to us before the end of the year with a workshop. So staff is planning to hold public workshops this year to collect information on the condition of Mono Lake Basin's public trust resource and evaluate potential management options. The workshops will focus on new data collected since the board issued decision 1631 and 1994. These are informal public workshops where a quorum of the board may be present, but no decisions will be made. So let's see here. So the first workshop will be on California goals of migratory waterfowl. That will be on June 1st from 1 to 2. And the second one will be on water quality, salinity, brine shrimp, and alkali flies. And that will be on Thursday, June 4th from 10 to noon. Also ongoing, not quite in your region, but quite nearby, is the Salt and Sea Management Plan. California Natural Resource Agency released Their Salt and Sea Management Program Annual Report on March 31st. The annual report is available in English, and they anticipate the report in Spanish to be finalized in the next couple of days. Once both versions are available, they will CNRA, the California Natural Resource Agency, will make a public announcement. The State Board will hold its annual workshop on the status of the Salt and Sea Management Program on May 20th. The workshop will take place as part of the State Board's regularly scheduled meeting and would begin at 9 a.m. The workshop is an opportunity for interested parties to provide input to the State Board regarding the status of the Salt and Sea Management Program. Input can be provided by submitting written comments by May 11th or providing oral comments during the workshop. Live Spanish interpretation will be provided on all platforms, and all workshop material will be translated into Spanish. Let's a couple more items here. A lot going on right now. So regulations for on-site treatment and reuse of non-potable water. The regulations have been approved by the Office of Administrative Law and are in effect as of April 22nd. State Board staff have updated the status of the regulations on our rulemaking webpage. Our Clean Water State Revolving Fund, CWSRF, State Board will conduct a board workshop to accept comments on May 19th. The draft, this will be for the fiscal year 26-27 for our intended use plan. This is our plan for how we will annually use the funds through the Clean Water SRF. So please, take a look. Public comments are due by May 27th, and the State Board will conduct a board meeting no earlier than July 7th, consider adopting the proposed IUP at our regularly scheduled board meeting. Also going on are stakeholder fee meetings. So staff are planning to meet with stakeholders on May 6th, that is today, to discuss possible changes to the fiscal year 26-27 water quality certification fees. This will be the third meeting for water quality certification fees. Staff also planning to hold general stakeholder meetings to discuss the fiscal year 26-27 fees. And then on June, so that will be on June 11th. Drinking water and ELAP fees will be also on June 11th. And then on June 12th, we'll have water quality and water right fees. And so a lot of fee meetings coming up here. This is also done annually to look at where our fees are and discuss whether to keep the fees the same, to increase them, or even potentially reduce them. So please tune in on those meetings there. In addition, let's see here, we have two more items. Our Wastewater Needs Assessment Advisory Group began meeting in July 2024. I want to thank Ben for all of his support on this effort. Then, since then, the group has facilitated eight advisory group meetings and provided support for office hours. The April 24th meeting included discussion of unsewered areas and map data gaps, updates to inadequate and at-risk facilities lists, as well as solutions and costs. So more information is on our webpage. And then last but definitely not least, the Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience. The advisory group will hold a meeting on May 28th from 9:30 to 4:30. And more information can be found on their program website. So that concludes my report. Apologies for being a little bit of a long one. There is a lot going on right now, busy time within the state.
Thank you so much, Board Member Morgan. Yeah, really busy time. Board members, do we have any comment or question for Board Member Morgan? Nope, seeing none. Thank you again very much for that presentation. Okay, so now we're on to our board in terms of updates or things. Let's start to my left, Board Member Deaver.
No updates.
Board Member Pierce.
No updates.
Board Member Cox.
I just want to welcome you all to Mojave Water Agency, the keepers of the groundwater in our 5,000 square mile service area. If you'd like a tour of the building later, we can arrange that for you.
Great, thank you. And thank you for hosting us at this beautiful facility. It's impressive. I have two just quick ones to put forward. I will be attending, and I'm sure Ben Lettenwill and other staff members as well, the Water Quality Coordinating Council next Thursday. I'll be there all day in person in Sacramento. I will not be there on Friday, but I'll probably be able to plug into a little bit remotely on Friday, but I'll be there and representing our board and listening and learning and working with other boards. The second one that I'd like to put forward is just a kind of a thank you and also an acknowledgement or a highlight that Ben and Dan Sussman and Dan McClure and I got the opportunity to be part of a gathering at Mono Lake yesterday. And it was Cal EPA's convening, I believe, and the tribal council of the tribal councils, and there were many tribes represented and people from literally all the state agencies that Cal EPA is a part of. And it was just fascinating. Not only did we get some great presentations, and Ben and Dan got to give a very nice presentation on tribal beneficial uses and what those are all about and where our status is and all of that, but we had a tremendous field day. Got an opportunity. It was a little cold in the beginning, a little wet and a little cold out at the lake, but got an opportunity to see some parts of the lake that most of us have never seen or at least don't get to go to often. And then we got the opportunity to go up with the Kazetica tribal elders and members to a piece of property they own up in the high country, and it was just really extraordinary. So that was fun and interesting, and I think it's going to help our TBU effort going forward. So anyway, that's what I've got. Anything else? The good of the order. All right, so we are now on to our items of decision and content, and we're on to item 4, which is an amended discharge requirements for the Mountain Pass Mine and Mill. This is on the uncontested calendar. It's adoption of amended waste discharge requirements for the Mountain Pass Mine and Mill. Would any board member or anyone from the public like to request a discussion and removal of item 4 from the uncontested calendar? And we can consider it separately. Members of the public participating in Zoom, please use the raise hand feature if you would like to be a part of that discussion. And I don't have a speaker card or anything. Ariel, we have any interest
No.
out there in the Zoom world? Okay.
No, we do not.
All right. Well, if no one, since there's no one from the public and board, I'm looking your way. I'm not seeing any need for discussion. So
I'll move approval of the item.
Okay. That was good. You're way ahead of me. All right. Move approval. Do we have a second?
I second.
Ariel, you're going to do the roll.
Member Cox?
Aye.
Member Deaver?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pierce?
Aye.
Chair Lux?
Aye.
All right, thank you. And thank you to staff for putting the work together and all the details and making it so easy on us that we can just kind of get things moving real quickly. So great work there and a really complete staff work. All right, do we move on to 5 now? I'm looking. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Okay. I've got a little script here. It's a little hard to figure. Okay. Item 5, adoption of waste discharge requirements for the Death Valley National Park, Cow Creek Reserve, reverse osmosis water treatment plant in Yoke County. That's a mouthful. The board will hold a public hearing to receive public comments and consider adopting the proposed waste discharge requirements for the Death Valley RO water treatment plant facility. The hearing will begin with a presentation from Water Board staff. Next, we'll hear comments from the public. I've got one speaker card already. There could be others or could be people on Zoom. But why don't we start with staff? Welcome and come on up.
There we go. All right. Good afternoon, board chair, board members, and members of the public. My name is Sergio Alonso, water resources control engineer from the Victorville office. Today, I will be presenting the proposed individual waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, for the Cow Creek Reverse Osmosis Water Treatment Plant located within Death Valley National Park. This facility is an important drinking water source for the Cow Creek housing area, and the order represents the first time the board is adopting a dedicated regulatory framework for the RO concentrate discharge at this location. Next slide. The presentation today will cover the following areas: a background on Cow Creek and operation of the RO water treatment plant, data comparison of the RO concentrate discharge and source water, the reasons for developing this order, required monitoring and reporting, public comments, and recommendation for adoption. Next slide. Death Valley is located in Eastern California within the Mojave Desert. It is known for having the lowest point in North America and is known for to have one of the hottest temperatures on Earth. Despite these extreme conditions, Death Valley has a surprisingly diverse ecology with desert-adopted plants like creosote and mesquite and wildlife like the bighorn sheep and coyotes. Cow Creek is part of the Death Valley National Park. Next slide. Cow Creek is the main administrative area for the National Park Service within Death Valley National Park. It includes the primary housing area for Park Service staff, with 71 housing units that support approximately 151 residents. The area also contains historic irrigation ditches, which support both native and non-native vegetation and are part of the long-standing cultural landscape within Cow Creek. In addition to the housing area, the site includes administrative buildings, maintenance yards, and warehouses that support park operations. This is also a location of the Cow Creek Reverse Osmosis Water Treatment Plant, which serves as a community's drinking water source. Understanding this setting is important because the RO plant and its discharge are integrated into an area that supports both residential use and historic irrigation features. Next slide. Here is a timeline that shows how the RO plant was built. In 2002, it was built to treat water from Navarre Springs. From 2002 through 2013, the RO concentrate produced by the system was discharged to the local irrigation ditch system at Cow Creek. In 2013, the Park Service redirected the concentrate to the Furnace Creek Wastewater Treatment Facility, combining flows from both the Cow Creek and the Furnace Creek RO plants. As mentioned earlier, this was done for a continuous set of years. However, this created operational and capacity issues with the wastewater treatment plant. In 2024, the Park Service shifted back to having the discharge go to the irrigation ditch system, where it continues today. And now in 2026, the board is considering the first individual waste discharge requirements for this facility. Next slide. The Cow Creek RO plant was constructed to provide potable water from the source water found in Navarre Springs. The plant is not designed to treat nor accept domestic waste. All domestic waste is treated at the Furnace Creek Wastewater Treatment Plant. The RO plant does generate RO concentrate as waste, which is the proposed board order intends to address. Next slide. The source water from Navarre Springs is split into two streams. One portion is directed into the RO system as feed water, and the other portion is directed into a bypass line. The RO process effectively removes the elevated total dissolved solids, or TDS, fluoride, arsenic, and other naturally high occurring minerals that are present in the spring water. The treated water is then supplied as potable water to the Cow Creek housing area within Death Valley National Park. The concentrate that results from the RO process contains the minerals removed during treatment. This is blended with the bypass water before discharge. This blending step helps manage concentrations in the final effluent. Next slide. The upgraded RO plant is capable of producing up to 50,000 gallons per day of potable water. The treated water is stored in a 350,000 gallon tank for community supply. Between April 2024 and June 2025, the plant produced an average of 15,334 gallons per day of RO concentrate, with a maximum of 31,124 gallons per day during that period. Next slide. Here, we compare the concentrate to the source water and the applicable maximum contaminant levels. Key observations in this table include TDS concentrations in the concentrate reach about 3,800 milligrams per liter, significantly higher than both the source water and the MCL of 500 milligrams per liter. Fluoride concentrations in the concentrate reach 16 milligrams per liter, again, higher than the source and the MCL of 2 milligrams per liter. Sulfate, calcium, and magnesium and sodium are also elevated. Arsenic reaches 0.041 milligrams per liter, exceeding the MCL of 0.01 milligrams per liter. These values affect the natural chemistry of the source water and the concentrating effect of the RO treatment. While the concentrate is not used for drinking water, its discharge must still be regulated to protect groundwater and comply with the basin plan. Also, because of the flow of bypass water to the pipeline leading to the discharge point, the blend of RO concentrate and bypass source water will reduce the concentrations shown in this table through blending. Next slide. This map illustrates the distances between Navarre Springs, the source where the source water originates, the RO treatment plant, and the housing area where the discharge point is located. The blue dotted line on the right side of the map shows source water from Navarre Springs being moved approximately 8,700 feet via pipeline from Navarre Springs to the plant. There is always a base flow of source water from Navarre Springs even when the RO plant is not utilizing the RO system. The blend of RO concentrate and bypass source water will travel approximately 3,000 feet to the discharge point at the irrigation ditch system. Next slide. On this map, you can see the location of the RO treatment plant itself, as well as a 350,000-gallon potable gallon storage tank. The Park Service plans on upgrading the RO treatment plant to a new building, shown here in black. From this building, the map outlines the source water transmission line from Navarre Springs to the east in the same blue dotted line as the previous map. In green is the mixing point where RO concentrate and bypass source water from the springs converge for transport to the irrigation ditch system via pipeline. This pipeline is shown in a light blue line that runs parallel with the solid dark blue line that will carry potable water from the storage tank. Next slide. This map is of the discharge area. The pipeline carrying the blended mix of RO concentrate and bypass source water will reach the discharge location shown in red. At this point, the discharge will be able to travel to the irrigation ditch system shown in dark blue. The irrigation ditch system has a north ditch and a south ditch. Park Service staff have the ability to manage the flows to either of the irrigation ditches as needed. The map also includes three light blue circles. These circles depict proposed or conceptual locations for a groundwater monitoring well network. The groundwater monitoring well network will monitor the impact the discharge may have on existing groundwater. Finalized groundwater monitoring locations will be proposed in a work plan following order adoption. Next slide. This photograph is of the pipeline where the blend of RO concentrate and bypass source water exit onto the irrigation ditch system. At this point is where one of the effluent samples is to be collected. The other effluent sampling points are at the plant where RO concentrate is sampled prior to blending with the bypass source water and downstream of the irrigation ditch system. Next slide. The proposed individual WDR is needed for several key reasons. To formally regulate the discharge of RO concentrate using a site-specific permit tailored to the facility, to prevent unauthorized discharge into the Furnace Creek Wastewater Treatment Facility, which previously experienced capacity issues, and to regulate the discharge to meet anti-degradation policy requirements, and to establish groundwater monitoring well network impacts to groundwater. Next slide. The proposed order requires a comprehensive suite of plans and reports, including a groundwater monitoring well network plan, a sampling and analysis plan, quarterly and annual monitoring reports, and unscheduled reports such as spills and incident reports, significant earthquake events, and extreme weather events to be submitted. These tools ensure ongoing accountability, transparent reporting, and early detection of any potential impacts. Next slide. The tentative WDR was issued for public comment to various entities in addition to the general public. The proposed WDR was issued to local and federal entities such as the National Park Service, consultants, the Timbisha Shoshone Tribe, and Inyo County. During the public period, no comments were received. Next slide. In closing, the Water Board staff recommend the adoption of the board order as proposed for the Cow Creek plant. We are confident that this order is protective of both groundwater and the surrounding environment. It establishes the necessary monitoring framework and provides clarity and regulatory certainty for the National Park Service, who operates the facility. Thank you for your time and attention. Back to you, Board Chair.
Thank you, Sergio. A great presentation and report. Really appreciate it. Really thorough and good maps and data for us. Let me begin. We've got at least one public comment. I've got a speaker card. We may have others. But before we get to the public comment, I'd like to see if there are any questions for board members or specific things while Sergio's up with us.
Just out of curiosity, do you know what the groundwater depth is around where the irrigation system is?
We can find out, but part of that includes establishing a monitoring well network.
Okay, there's no wells out there right now then.
No, I don't have that number.
Thanks.
I've just got one. How about approximately, I know it will probably vary, obviously, with seasonality, et cetera, but how much mixing is there? What's the dilution factor in terms of the raw water coming in that they mix before it's discharged?
I don't exactly recall the exact approximate numbers, but it does dilute it quite a bit. We still need to gather, because we don't have enough data to show what the blending results are. We have asked the Park Service to begin sampling and let us know exactly how that entails. There are estimates. We have calculated estimates, but we don't have any exact results officially.
Okay, thanks. And I'm sure it will vary a bit seasonally. It's by how much discharge. Because if I'm understanding correctly, the RO concentrate, you're showing in the table that you showed us the highest concentrations. It doesn't mean it's always that high, right? Because if it were, I'm kind of wondering how source water that's higher than the MCL mixing with RO water that's higher than the MCL gets us to the MCL.
It can't, just because it's naturally higher than the MCL.
Yeah, but these represent the maximum concentrations, and presumably there's a substantial fluctuation in that. Or?
So these higher numbers with the RO concentrate, we're hoping with the blending of the source water, try to bring it as close back to background as possible.
Yeah, right. Okay. Any other questions, board members? Okay, that's all I had. Thanks so much, Sergio. All right, now we'll move on to the some public comment. And anyone on the Zoom platform? I'm just trying to gauge what we've got here in terms of numbers.
No.
Okay, I've got one speaker card, and I'm going to mispronounce your name, Brian, and I'm sorry to be Brian Alloyed, something, National Park Service from Death Valley National Park. Welcome, and normally we have 3 minutes for comments, but given that I think you're our only speaker, I'll give you a little leeway there if you need it.
No, I think we can do it under 3 minutes. And yes, my name is Brian Ayo. I'm the Chief of Maintenance for Death Valley National Park. Members of the Lahontan Regional Water Board, thank you for reviewing the National Park Service plan to reuse concentrate water at Cow Creek Reverse Osmosis Treatment Plant for irrigation. I also thank you for the opportunity to provide a comment from the National Park Service, and I appreciate the work that Sergio and the Lahontan staff has put into this application. We recognize that that has been a workload for them, and thanks, Sergio, for that great presentation. This water conservation measure aboard Death Valley National Park reduces water waste, better preserves and protects natural and cultural resources in the historic Cow Creek housing area, and improves employee morale and quality of life. NPS utility workers, hydrologists, and other scientists monitor the water systems and are working to document system changes as repairs are made to the system. Water reuse is also a key element in a Great American Outdoors Act funded project to rehabilitate the water and wastewater systems at Cow Creek and Furnace Creek. This project replaces critical and failing water and wastewater systems that serve Death Valley National Park. The Timbisha Shoshone Village and Zantara's Oasis and Inn at Death Valley Resort. Protecting public safety, providing for tourism in Eastern California, and investing tens of millions of dollars into an infrastructure project in Inyo County. On behalf of Death Valley National Park, we thank you for your time and consideration to collaborate with the National Park Service. I and my colleagues joining online are happy to answer any questions you may have about the beneficial reuse of concentrate water to preserve natural and cultural resources in Death Valley. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate you being here. All right. Anyone else from the public? It's the only speaker card I have. I'm seeing no one, and no one else on Zoom platform. All right. With that,
Before you move forward, Chair, I just wanted to respond to the question from Vice Chair Pierce regarding groundwater depths, because we found it in the permit. So I'll just read the paragraph on bait stamp 5-8. So it says, geotechnical investigations in the vicinity of the proposed discharge point in the housing area revealed that groundwater was not encountered at depths of 13.4 feet and 30.5 feet below the ground surface, indicating that the saturated zone is deeper than these levels. Geotechnical investigations conducted approximately half a mile to the west, downgradient, of the irrigation ditch revealed that the groundwater was encountered at depths of 9.5 and 10.5 feet below the ground surface. These groundwater levels are not static and can fluctuate due to precipitation, runoff, and nearby spring activities.
Okay, thanks. All right, board, we'll bring it back. I guess we officially close the public hearing component of this, bring it back to the board for deliberation. Any comments, concerns, questions, deliberations? Everybody wants to move forward? Okay, I'm kind of in the same boat. So I think, Ariel, we'll look for a motion.
I'll motion. You vote on it.
I'll second it.
Sorry.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Ariel, you get to do your
sorry, your roll call. This is Elizabeth. I know it's obvious, but could you clarify what the motion is doing? And I'm assuming it's adopting the permit.
Yes, the adoption of the waste discharge for the reverse osmosis water plant at Cow Creek.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I will call a roll call vote. Member Cox?
Aye.
Member Deaver?
Aye.
Vice Chair Pierce?
Aye.
Chair Lutz?
Aye. All right, the item passes. And again, thank you, Sergio, and thanks to the National Park Service. Good luck with that, and hope it's not too hot this summer. All right, moving along. We are moving fast here. Item 6, long-term complex item, and we're getting a status update. We don't have decision-making on this one, but it's a statewide PFAS investigation summary for drinking water and Lahontan PFAS investigations update and recap. And we've got some staff presentation work on this, I know, and there'll probably be some questions and comment. As I said, the board will not be making any decisions on this. There's no particular item in front of us. But who do we have from staff coming up on this one?
We are actually going to start with the... We're going to start with Wendy and Dan on Zoom.
On Zoom. Okay, great. Welcome, Wendy and Dan, on Zoom. We'll be looking forward to hearing from you.
All right. Well, good afternoon, Board Chair and the board members and the public. We really appreciate your time this afternoon. We have a short presentation to go over. My name is Wendy Link. I work in the Division of Water Quality at the State Water Resource Control Board. I'm a geologist by background, and I'm a specialist, and I have to do with all the orders and have to do with understanding PFAS in the Division of Water Quality. And my colleague, Dan Newton, is the Assistant Deputy Director with the Division of Drinking Water. He regulates 4,000 water systems during the day, and PFAS, as he says, is his nighttime job. So we're here today to give you an update on a statewide summary of what we've been discovering and understanding for PFAS and drinking water statewide. We're also going to give you a little bit of a peek-see on what we see within your region. So next slide, please. So I'm going to talk about our monitoring orders that we've issued. I will talk about the water quality side. Dan will talk about the drinking water side. We're going to kind of tag team a little bit back and forth among these slides. Dan will talk about the public water supply and the data that we have for PFAS and our recent investigative efforts that have been going on since 2019. And then also the statewide regulatory approach that is coming up and being discussed for drinking water. Next slide, please. You know, when we talk about PFAS, we're going to talk about quite a few acronyms during this presentation, so I thought I'd bring those up. There will be about six of them that we're going to talk about. There's going to be three of them that we're going to mention in particular. PFOA and PFOS are two acronyms, are two PFAS compounds that have been studied a lot and have been in the radar for many decades now. The next one is going to be PFHXS. That is another what we call a sulfonate. The S means sulfonate that will be mentioned today. The other three are not as prevalent in drinking water. They are called PFNA, HFPODA, which is also known as GenX, and PFBS, which is another sulfonate. So I just wanted to throw out those six acronyms in case they come at you. And we can explain more about them if you're interested. So on the Division of Water Quality side, we've been investigating PFAS at suspected sources, industrial source sites, in coordination with the Division of Drinking Water. We've been issuing monitoring orders and have collected data having to do with those source sites. And some of those are passive receivers of PFAS. Those source sites that are including airports that use an aqueous film-forming foam, AFFF. It includes a PFAS compounds within it, and as well as those bulk field terminals and refineries having to do with emergency response. They need that AFFF for emergency chemical fires. Chrome platers use a universal mist suppressant that has a PFOS or a now a different replacement product for PFAS within their industrial activities. And those passive receivers that unfortunately also get PFAS, and that's landfills because of consumer products, carpets and rugs, and other things that are actually disposed of in landfills also create PFAS, especially in landfill leachate, and secondarily from wastewater treatment plants. PFAS comes out of either from industrial discharges or from just municipal or industrial wastewater. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Wendy. And a quick note, good day, board members. We're always happy, Wendy and I are always happy to talk about PFAS. It's a very fascinating topic and an incredibly challenging topic. And so we've got some good information here to share with you. A quick thanks to Ben for inviting us. It's a pleasure to be here and share what we know so far. So as Wendy noted, the groundwater investigations on the prior slide, DDW issued monitoring orders for the drinking water wells. And what we have in front of us are all the locations statewide where we monitored source wells. And so in 2019, we issued our first order to monitor the drinking water source wells adjacent to the sites that Wendy just mentioned in the previous groundwater orders. So those were the airports, landfills, chrome platers, firefighting areas. We reached out on a radius of roughly 1 mile to 2 miles to check any adjacent drinking water sources. So the 2019 order hit roughly 600 source wells, but was essentially looking for PFAS where we thought we would find it. In 2022, we expanded that effort wildly with a 2022 order to roughly 1,100 sources. And this was looking for drinking water wells that were adjacent to the prior order. So we were reaching out, so to speak, to chase those. And I hesitate to use the word plume, but we were reaching out to look at further impact and how far some of that impact occurred. We just recently amended that order to pick up some new levels, notification levels and response levels that were issued by the Division of Drinking Water. So we've got an update here noted in the bullet of 2026. In 2024, the state, through a piece of legislation, received some funding to provide a one-time, free-of-charge PFAS sampling at wells serving disadvantaged communities statewide. That was roughly 3,400 wells. So we partnered with Sac State and GeoSynTech through a contractive process, and the boots on the ground sampled the wells. We had a contract lab that did the testing, and we provided that feedback to these disadvantaged communities. We just finished this effort. It was roughly a year and a half of intense sampling and traveling throughout the state to check all of these wells to understand impact statewide. What's fascinating about the 2024 order that's different than the prior two is we were looking for PFAS where we thought we would not find it. In other words, the 2024 order was a great cross-section of the state. We're out in the desert, we're in urban, we're in rural, we're in ag, and everything in between, all four or five corners of the state on how you look at it. In 2025, just recently, this December, I believe it was, we issued our most recent order. This required testing at all sources that that we regulate, roughly 12,000 sources. Now, there's some duplication here. A source may be under several orders. But what the 2025 order does is it clarifies and ensures compliance with the federal PFAS monitoring rule. The federal US EPA issued the PFAS rule with MCLs, six of them. And there is a period called the initial monitoring period, where all water systems shall monitor based on system size. They have roughly a year and a half to do that. Our order, our 2025 order, clarified the very complicated rule and provided a list of wells and the frequency of sampling to make this easier for water systems, thereby allowing us to track and ensure compliance. We are able to issue a monitoring violation at the beginning of 2027, should systems not monitor. And that dovetails a little bit into the bottom bullet here, the federal PFAS monitoring requirement. I mentioned the initial monitoring period. And again, that's so all systems monitor per the federal rule as we move forward with the MCLs. Next slide, please. A quick snapshot here on just how much sampling we've done. And so this is broken down by system type and system size. So the number of sources that we've sampled for large systems, roughly 3,000, and for small systems, 2,600. We sample those sources several times. Some of the orders required quarterly sampling. As I mentioned, the 24 order required a single time sample. But you can see we've got a fair amount of sampling performed throughout the state. Breaking that down by the type of public water system, groundwater versus surface water, you can see we've focused heavily on the groundwater. Surface water is a little bit more tricky, and we're entering that realm now with the initial monitoring period as required by the federal government or federal EPA. Still learning more on the surface water side, but as you all know, surface water is a bit of a hit and miss as we sampled, depending on peak flow. Groundwater, what we found with PFAS is a little more stable, even seasonally. So just a quick tidbit of information there. Next slide, please. This slide is a summary of what we found. When Wendy and I, just a side note, when Wendy and I started this effort in 2019 and PFAS was a really big unknown, there's 10,000 versions of this particular class of chemicals, and we expected to find thousands. And the good news is, if there is a silver lining in this particular chemical, is that we're seeing more non-detection wells than we anticipated. At least personally, I am. So I'll go over this slide here a little bit, and this is on the targeted methods. This is US EPA method 533, which has, correct me if I'm wrong, Wendy, 25 analytes that, yes, I've got a nod from you. We've got 25 analytes in method 533. Of those 25 analytes, roughly 60%, pardon me, 56 or 57% of our wells have non-detect of all of those analytes. That's relatively good news in my perspective compared to what I thought we would see. However, we have roughly 7% of the wells that have a detection of analytes outside of the federal MCLs, and roughly 36% of the wells have one of the six exceedances of one of the six federal MCLs. Next slide, please. This is an interesting chart, one of my favorite in the slideshow here. We've got a couple of these. I want to draw your attention to the bubbles. That's the main take home of this slide, or of this this graph. It's called an upset chart, and we just ran this recently. What we have in the bubbles are the six analytes, or listed on the left, are the six analytes that have a federally proposed or a federal MCL. As we move across, these are all the combinations of what we have found so far in our testing. And when you take six of the combinations, I believe if my math is correct, we can get over 60 possible combinations. What we have here is under 30. Again, relatively good news. What is interesting on this is that these combinations, if you look at the bottom left in the bar charts, you can see the number of occurrences where this analyte shows up. So I'll start at the very bottom left. We have 1,312 occurrences of a PFOS detection. Now, if I draw your attention to the very top of the graph with the vertical charts or the vertical bars, these are the number of times this particular combination of analytes shows up. What we've been looking for is there a signature based on a particular source type or location? We're really trying to understand how PFAS is impacting the state based on demographics and geography and, well, location throughout the state. This chart's a first step in that direction. Really quickly, you can see that we have a couple combinations on the left that are quite prevalent. But as you move to the right of the chart on those vertical bars, we got some combinations out there that are quite unique or rare. Then again, what we're not seeing here are the combinations that have zero detections or zero presence. PFOA, PFHXS, and PFOS are the key players. Now, PFBS is also getting a lot of detections, but its health impact level that we have is relatively high. So if I move to the next slide, please, it will demonstrate what we have as far as MCL exceedances that really brings this chart down.
Oh, there you are. You're back, Jim. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, my apologies. So this slide shows the exceedances. It's basically the prior slide was detections, and what we're using as a detection is 2 parts per trillion, so incredibly low. This slide represents the same six MCL analytes that have an MCL exceedance, and you can see the numbers drop significantly. The key players being PFOS, PFOA, and we've got those highlighted in a orange or red box. And then we also have PFHXS, which is in a blue box. The reason why we put that in a blue box is that federal EPA is proposing the rescission of 4 of the 6 MCLs. Basically, federal EPA is moving forward with MCLs for PFOA and PFOS. The good news, unfortunately, with that, those redactions of those MCLs, is that PFOA and PFOS are predominantly present with all other analytes that have an exceedance. So by treating or looking for PFOA and PFOS, we're picking up a majority of the PFAS contamination. PFHXS, as it's rescinded by a federal EPA, DDW is moving forward with a PHG. We made a request for a PHG. My understanding is that OEHA is getting near ready to provide us with a draft, and we will move forward with a state MCL for PFHXS. Looking at PFHXS as you move across the bar graph here, or the bubbles, you can see under the 14, the vertical under 14, we have roughly 14 wells or systems that have only PFHXS as an exceedance. They did not come along with PFO or PFOS. Hence, DDW looking for an MCL to cover all bases. Once we have those three MCLs, again, we'll have most of the state covered. We have two occurrences of PFNA exceedances, and really that's about it. PFBS is not on here. As you saw in the other graph, even though we have a lot of detections of PFBS, its health level is quite high. Thereby, we don't have an exceedance, so it's not making it to this chart. Next slide, please.
So overall, what we're summarizing here in this chart, that we're showing essentially all of it together for those six analytes that currently have an MCL, PFO, PFOS, PFHXS, PFBS, PFNA, and HFPODA. The green has to show what those non-detects that we mentioned in that donut chart a couple slides ago. The blue is where the detections are between, it's above detection limit, but below the maximum contaminant level that's assigned for those analytes. And then the red is where it's above the MCL. So essentially, once again, it's reinforcing, showing that PFO and PFOS, especially PFOS, is the one that is the leader of the pack that has the most exceedances for above the MCL, then the PFOA, and then PFHXS is also one. But as Dan mentioned, we're going to be covering that with the response level and the public health goal that will be issued from OER. So essentially, we're covering all the analytes so far that is being seen in drinking water already, pretty much, that exceed an MCL in the targeted list. Next slide, please. And this is a map to kind of give you an idea of the general distribution of those occurrences where we do exceed the MCL in all of those sampling locations that we've been talking about in the previous slides. The dark blue is when we see one occurrence that exceeds the MCL. The light blue is when we see two of those analytes that exceed the MCL, and so on and so forth. And you can see that pretty much everything is either a dark blue or a light blue. And essentially, that's that combination with PFO and PFOS. They are hanging around together, and they are being seen in quite a few of the water supply wells across the state. Next slide.
Thank you, Wendy. And so, what does the regulatory future look like? I mentioned the federal MCLs. Next slide, please. And that is currently underway. California is working to adopt the federal MCLs here so that DDW can enforce those. I mentioned the initial monitoring period. And so at this point, all systems are monitoring for PFAS, either semi-annual or quarterly. All that monitoring must be completed by April of 2027. And again, we have an order that is tracking that to ensure compliance and clarity and when systems should test. The federal EPA, though, for lack of a better word, likely rescinded four of the MCLs and will likely extend the compliance for delivery of water to meet the MCLs until 2031. Right now, it's 2029. We technically have MCLs. But we are unable to enforce the delivery of that MCL until 2029. Again, I believe that's going to, fairly certain that's going to be pushed out to 2031 so that systems have time to budget and construct their treatment plants. What we have on the graph on the right, or the table on the right, are sampling locations to date. In red, we're showing where we have exceedances of the six MCLs. And so there's a bit of a trend here. You can see that along some of the corridors. And I will zoom in to Region 6. Next slide, please. Region 6 is, as you all know, hard to fit on a screen sometimes. So we did a bit of a zoom in on the more concentrated area. Throughout the region, we do have some treatment occurring up north, I believe at the Sierra Army Depot. So we have compliance up there. But most of the exceedances are occurring down in the southern portion of the region. The breakout or the detail map shows those locations. In my discussions with the district engineer that oversees this area, it appears the exceedances are relatively low-level exceedances. In other words, not extremely high, but certainly an exceedance of an MCL. Next slide, please. A quick summary of all of the levels that we have here in DDW. Starting on the left, we have the California levels that we've established over the years and have adjusted more than once. But we've got PFO and PFOS at the top. That's on purpose. Those are followed by a hashtag. As you move across, you see the US EPA MCLs of 4.0. Moving down, we have PFH excess. As noted earlier, in progress is a public health goal so that we can move forward with an MCL. We currently have notification levels and response levels. And the response levels that we have here in California have motivated a lot of systems to take action. Those response levels, if exceeded, require public notification. They're not MCLs, but that threat of public notification has prompted many systems to take action proactively. Moving across, we have the same analytes highlighted in red under federal EPA. The red are what we're showing as likely to be rescinded. In fact, we heard yesterday, and we didn't have time to adjust our slideshow here, but OMB approved the redaction of those four MCLs. So it's I believe it's a matter of time and not a matter of if. As I noted, if those MCLs do vacate or disappear, again, PFO and PFOS are great sentinels and represent most of the state. And we're going to try to capture the rest of that with our other state MCLs moving forward. The other levels, PFHXA, PFBS, PFNA, Gen X, they're relatively high levels. And so we don't see exceedances of any of our advisory levels or MCLs on those chemicals. Next slide, please. I mentioned the federal MCLs, and so what we're doing is we're calling that stage one. California is moving forward to adopt the six MCLs, and I keep saying six because it's not official yet, but it'll probably be two MCLs for PFO and PFOS, and that is likely to occur the end of this year, maybe into next year, by the time we get to the board and go through the rulemaking process. Our 2025 order that we issued helps support that moving forward of the MCLs. I want to draw attention to stage two. This is where it gets a little bit fascinating and the iceberg comes into play. Stage two is an approach that we are moving forward with. Wendy and I have been working on since early 2019 to develop a broad spectrum method to understand the total mass of PFAS impact in California. We've worked on several methods that could provide that information. Long story short, there is no perfect method to check total mass of PFAS. Each method that we've have explored and tested has a hole or a vacancy or leaves information unknown. However, over the years, over the past two or three years, we've made some pretty good advancements in refining some of those. So there's still hope that we can have a mass approach, but we also, a subset of the wells that we've tested statewide, roughly 600 wells, we have performed NTA, full NTA and full ultra, or pardon me, ultra short high res mass spectrometry on sampling. So we have a wealth of information well beyond the targeted methods of what PFAS impact in California looks like, beyond those that federal EPA is looking at. This study that we did was developed in conjunction with federal EPA prior to the Office of Research and Development being disbanded or dispersed. And so it was with their assistance, along with our lab and some funding statewide, that we've really got a pretty good picture of statewide PFAS impact beyond the 25 analytes. More to come on that front. We've got a lot of data. We're doing a lot of analysis and working with our lab as we wrap that up. But I do see a future where we're able to regulate a class of PFAS as we move forward so that water systems can invest in infrastructure with some confidence. Next slide, please. And a quick summary as we bring this on home. In preparation of the future, we've got, as I mentioned, PFHXS. We're looking for an MCL. Second check mark. We also have developed a method for drinking water, a TFA method, trifluoroacetic acid. In California, we're considering that a PFAS. It's a three-chain carbon PFAS, and it's very slippery. It's likely one of those PFAS that we will be unable to treat for, but it seems to be quite ubiquitous. In December of 25, we issued an order statewide for all sources to monitor for PFAS. I mentioned that earlier. As we move forward under the second blue bullet for proposed rulemaking, we're still looking on a broad spectrum method as the state moves forward. So stage one, adopt the federal MCLs. Stage two, and this will take several years, develop a California approach. And I believe that's covered in state in the second bullet here, the 2026 rulemaking for federal MCLs. And next slide. And I believe, Wendy, this is where you bring us on.
I want to bring it home. So all the data that we talked about, including drinking water and the water quality side, groundwater, storm water, you know, soils that have been collected at those source sites, are all available on the GeoTracker PFAS map. So it is available for the public to download and look at the data as well. Next slide, please. So we want to take the time to thank you today for your time, and we're here to answer any questions that you have. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Daniel and Wendy. I think what I'm going to do now, before we hear from our staff, from Anna and from Alonzo, is just see if there's any specific kind of technical kind of questions or from board members to Wendy and Dan, kind of which might kind of help with our regional situation as well. Board Member Cox, why don't you start?
Thank you, Chair. On a wonderful presentation, by the way. I mean, this is so detailed and appreciate the work that you're doing on this. On slides 3 and 4, you showed just some really nice maps, but the last map you showed on GeoTracker, is there a way to kind of separate out the data points that you're showing on 3 and 4 from the overall water quality map that you're showing on slide 17?
You can, board member. It is a recent addition to GeoTracker, in fact. So on the left side, there's two ways. On the GeoTracker PFAS map, there is all the orders and all the different, whether it's water quality or drinking water. That's one way to split it out. You could unselect one of those or all of them, right? If you wanted to just look at drinking water, for example. And the other way is that we have a lasso tool. So you can click on an icon that's up on the top of the map, and I'm more than happy to show you offline if you'd like. And you can actually circle an area if you're really interested in a certain area, and then it will bring only that data out for you. Third is that there are filters as well for different types of samples and also chemicals. So if you only want to look at PFOS, you can change that chemical filter, use your lasso tool, or look only at drinking water and so on. So I've got a lot of multiple ways in order for you to look at the data.
Thank you for that. And the treatment for this is going to be so expensive for the water companies that have to address these constituents. Are you hearing of any grant funding out there? Because all this flows to the ratepayers. Some of these areas are disadvantaged communities. What are you seeing in the possibility of grant funding?
And yes, yeah, so part of the 2024 order where we sampled for free of charge the disadvantaged communities was to understand that. Part of that was to understand the financial impact. The treatment for this is relatively straightforward in the drinking water world. It's granulated activated carbon or ion exchange, mm-hmm. albeit many of these systems have never had to treat before. So this will be their first foray into treatment. And that brings a host of complications such as advanced certification for operators, et cetera. So it brings a host or cascading effect of issues. The Biden administration passed the bipartisan infrastructure law. I'm blank on the year, but that funding is available for constituents of emerging concern, which covers PFAS. So I worked with DFA to establish a majority of that funding to be available for PFAS. As we tested at those disadvantaged communities, when we had a detection, we provided a funding packet and contact information with the Division of Financial Assistance to reach out for funding. There are grants available and low interest loans. And so we were hoping that that would drum up a lot of proactive installations or activities. What's challenging is the federal EPA pulling MCLs certainly provides a climate of uncertainty. And so I'm just guessing, but I believe a lot of citizens were holding to wait till MCL stabilized before they took action. Unfortunately, that money's soon to expire. And so we've been working with DFA to try to work on a marketing campaign and reaching out to ensure that we've got systems that that need it are reached out to and again solicited for possible assistance.
Great. Thank you so much for that.
Board Member Pierce, do you have any questions?
Yes, I do. Maybe this is out of place since the testing's on water systems, but I'm up there in Inyo and Mono County. Most everybody's on individual wells. Is there a way that person can have their water tested? Is there funding to help with that? I'm just kind of curious on that end of things.
Yeah, it's I too am on a well. Yes, that is a challenge. DDW regulates public water systems, and a lot of the funding is designed around that. There is a lot of talk about that. We've been looking for opportunities for public well assistance. Wendy, I believe DWR was looking at that, but we don't. And I'll just cut to the chase. There really is no good opportunities for public water, or pardon me, private domestic well sampling. It is very pricey. A person could grab a sample and have it tested under at quite a cost. I would also, it's not easy to test for PFAS. It's very easy to have false results due to not proper preparation or showering or wearing the wrong material while you're sampling. It's a tricky analyte. So that is a very much an area that that it doesn't have a lot of attention.
Thank you.
Board Member Deaver.
Yeah, I have a question. I'd like to revisit slide 7.
The upset detect chart, Dan.
Oh, good. Yeah. Like I said, that's my favorite. I'd love to talk more about that.
Oh, great. So I must have missed it. The number of detections, are those individual wells?
Yes.
Yes. I don't have the slide in front of me. My apologies. I left them at the office.
Bring up the slide if you could.
Yeah, please. Do you have a particular analyte you're looking at or a part of this?
Okay, there we go. So those are all separate wells. Are any of those lake water used for drinking or all wells?
So at this point, we have a few surface water, not all. We're still receiving data on the 2025. So the 2025 order is all systems. Some systems are slow on doing that by semi-annual testing. So we don't have all surface water. We do primarily have all groundwater at this point, but this doesn't include all surface water yet.
And each of these wells was tested one time, and this is a result?
At least once. We have several wells that were tested probably 8 to 10 times by now. And so these aren't just an occurrence. This is just a well. The way these charts are laid out, this multiple testing at a well with an exceedance is not counted multiple times. It's counted once.
Okay, great. Thank you. Very, very nice chart.
Yeah, I love this graph. I've just got one kind of very broad general question. And without terrifying us, what are the health effects of these chemicals in general?
So PFOA and PFOS are the most well-known. A lot of these analytes, we don't know the health impact, and that's the unknown here. We're going into an arena. Typically in drinking water, we know the health impact, and then we regulate. This is a bit backwards. We're going in to understand with our eyes wide open what presence and prevalence so that we can focus our resources on where to study health impact. That's kind of the fascinating approach here as we do broad spectrum. In general, these cause cancer, low birth rate, thyroid defects. It runs the range. Each analyte brings its own special, unique impact, hence the very complicated challenge of PFAS. My biggest concern at this point is PFH excess. Even though the federal government's looking at dropping PFH excess from the list of analytes with an MCL, we're moving forward, and because it's a neurodevelopmental issue, in a low thyroid issue or a thyroid impact issue with the fetus and children 0 to 12 months. So it's an acute concern, even though federal EPA is regulating it quarterly as a chronic. So there's a bit of science conflict there. We're moving forward with PFH excess and our own NCL, and I expect it to be very low. PFOA and PFOS are long-term, more chronic. Those are cancer effects are the endpoints on those two. They're longer chain. And so each chain length and even the same chain length can have a different health impact depending on the head of the PFAS. So it's a challenging topic.
Thanks. That was really helpful. Any other questions, board members? All right. Well, thanks again. Appreciate it. Stick around a little bit because we may have some questions that circle back to you after Anna and Alonzo do their presentation. Welcome, and here you go.
Thank you. Can we pull up the second slide deck? Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Anna Garcia, and I'm a senior engineering geologist from your Planning, Restoration, and Sustainability Division, and I will be tag-teaming this presentation with Alonzo Poach, supervising engineering geologist and division manager of the Planning, Restoration, and Sustainability Division. Next slide, please. As previously indicated, in March 2019, the State Water Board issued investigative orders pursuant to California Water Code Section 13267 to a select group of landfill and airport facilities where PFAS were used or where materials suspected of containing PFAS were disposed of to investigate the presence of PFAS. We refer to these as the PFAS investigative orders. This was the beginning of a statewide effort led by a State Water Board to determine whether groundwater or other media, including soil, stormwater, and wastewater, is impacted by PFAS, and to obtain a preliminary understanding of PFAS concentrations associated with certain types of facilities. PFAS investigative orders were subsequently issued to other industries, including chrome platers, in October 2019, Publicly Owned Treatment Works, or POTWs, in July 2020, and Bulk Fuel and Storage Refineries in March 2021. The map on the right side shows the distribution and number of facilities in Region 6 that were issued a PFAS investigation order by facility type. It should be noted that no chrome platers were identified in Region 6, so no chrome plating facilities are shown on the map. Next slide, please. 26 landfills in Region 6 were issued PFAS investigative orders and were required to sample and analyze both groundwater and landfill leachate from a select number of locations so as to be representative of all conditions at a facility. PFOA and PFOS were detected in most of the groundwater samples and in all of the leachate samples collected as part of the landfill investigations. Since the 2022 staff report and informational item, we are evaluating the application of a tiered approach to PFAS sampling strategies across all landfills in our region. Lahontan staff are coordinating with State Board staff on this effort. For landfills that have not conducted PFAS sampling, a one-time PFAS sampling event will be required as waste discharge requirements are updated or revised. For example, Benton Crossing Landfill was issued a closure and post-closure waste discharge requirements in November 2025, which include conducting a one-time PFAS sampling event. The discharger is in the process of developing a sampling and analysis plan for this work. We make reference to the 2022 staff report in several slides. If board members wish to review the 2022 staff report, there's a live hyperlink to it in the green sheet starting on Bates Stamp 6-1 of the board packet. Next slide, please. 17 POTWs in Region 6 were issued the PFAS investigative orders and were required to perform quarterly sampling over a one-year period for influent, effluent, groundwater, and biosolids. In general, Region 6 POTW data results are less than statewide POTW maximum concentrations for PFOA and PFOS. Since the May 2022 staff report and informational item, no new updates are available for the POTWs that were assessed under the PFAS investigative orders. And now I will turn the presentation over to Alonzo Poach. Next slide, please.
Good afternoon, board members, members of the public. Alonzo Poach, supervising engineering geologist. I'll recap some of the other sites. So PFAS at airports, they were issued investigative orders. Since the May 2022 staff report informational item, Mammoth Yosemite Airport and SDLA are now in voluntary cost recovery in the site cleanup program and are developing and implementing work plans for additional PFAS investigations. SDLA has requested extensions due to contracting efforts with their consultants. And Mammoth Yosemite Airport has an approved work plan for collecting additional soil samples and installing 5 new monitoring wells. This work plan was approved in late January 2026 and they are in the process of implementing this work plan. On the slide here is a recap from the investigations that were presented, the maximum contaminations of PFOS at those particular facilities. And the highest concentrations, as you can see, were collected at Southern California Logistics Airport here in Victorville. Next slide, please. In March of 2021, PFAS and orders were issued to BNSF Rail Yard and Calnev Pipeline Company, Kinder Morgan Calnev. BNSF requested relief from this PFAS investigative order as they showed documentation that they never used chemicals that contained PFAS. Calnev's preliminary investigation work plan was accepted in 2021, and now the facility is in voluntary cost recovery since the May 2022 staff report. Additional PFAS investigation is ongoing as of April 2026. Soil sampling and up to 3 new monitoring wells will be installed with an anticipated completion date of summer of 2026. Next slide, please. Next, I'll go into an update on our DOD facilities. PFAS investigations started early and as early as the mid-2010s. So the DOD began self-monitoring under the Comprehensive Environmental Response, Compensation, and Liability Act, also known as CERCLA, process, and were not issued PFAS investigative orders. Since the May 2022 staff report and informational item, a majority of the DOD facilities in Lahontan are now in the remedial investigation phase. For PFAS related to firefighting foam releases. Those sites include fire stations, hangars, burned areas, aircraft crash sites, industrial wastewater discharge areas, and other miscellaneous sites. Next slide, please. These slides here show a recap of what was presented in the May 2022 staff report showing maximum concentrations and for each facility, the types of sites that were investigated and where they were at that time in the CERCLA investigation phase. So you'll see acronyms SI and RI. That means the sites are in a mixture of the site investigation, remedial investigation phase. And for instance, the max detected PFOS and PFOA detected at Naval Air Weapon Station China Lake was 8 million parts per trillion. Marine Corps Base Barstow, also a mix of the SI and RI phase and CERCLA, they had a maximum level of 1,531 parts per trillion. They also identified 2 offsite domestic wells that were impacted by PFAS. However, those particular domestic wells were located at abandoned or uninhabited facilities, so it was difficult to gain access to them because the property owners were not there. There was actually some squatters in a few of them, but there was evidence shown by the Navy that those wells were disconnected and not in use. Mountain Warfare Training Center had not sampled at the time of the May 2022 staff report, and they are moving along in the RI phase. Next slide, please. This is a continuation of all the military facilities. Edwards Air Force Base was in the remedial investigation phase at the time, and they had a max detection of 110,000 parts per trillion. Former George Air Force Base was in the site investigation phase. They had a maximum detected PFOS, PFOA of 5,390. They had two off-site domestic wells that were impacted. One of them was taken offline, and the property, I think, was purchased by the city of Victorville. And the other off-site domestic well, the Air Force installed a point-of-entry treatment system on the well, and they're currently maintaining that system right now. Air Force Plant 42 was in the SI phase at the time, and they had they were also in the site investigation phase, and they had a maximum detection of 18 parts per trillion. Fort Irwin was in the PA and SI stages at the time of that 2022 staff report and informational item. Next slide, please. So to recap, a majority of the DOD facilities are now in the RI phase. Fort Irwin has completed a preliminary assessment site investigation for PFAS. Many of them are, some of them have completed first phase, and many are implementing or developing work plans now. This is a phased approach, as Wendy and Dan touched on earlier in the presentation. Not a lot is known about the effects of these of the toxicology of these chemicals. So the military in general has deferred risk assessments to a further time. So the main focus has been delineating the nature and extent of contamination at the facilities. This is a time I'll plug the DOD informational item. So we had Marine Corps Logistics Base Barstow, and tomorrow you hear about George Air Force Base. So you'll hear updates on those investigations and those DOD informational items as we bring them to the board. And again, recapping, George Air Force Base had a point of entry treatment system installed on a private residential well. And DOD is prioritizing removal actions and treatment based on exceedances three times the MCLs. Next slide, please. That concludes our presentation, the update. And thank you. Back to you, Board Chair.
Thanks so much. Good work, and appreciate the update. Why don't I start with the board questions or comments? I'll go look to my left, and Board Member Neighbor.
Hello. Hey, do you guys know, has the firefighting foam been reformulated?
The firefighting foam has been reformulated to not contain...
It still has it?
PFAS for land applications, so... my understanding is the Navy still uses the fluorine containing foam on like ships because there's a incompatibility with salt water. But most of the DOD facilities have converted to not fluorine free foam in their hangars and firefighting efforts. They also don't train with it anymore, so they used to actually train with it at these fire training facilities. So they're not training with the foam anymore. I don't know if that's changed since they've switched formulations, but there is a DOD formulation that is fluorine free.
All right, great, thank you.
Board Member Pierce.
I have no questions. Thank you. That's very informative.
Board Member Cox.
Thank you, Chair. At the facilities like Edwards and George and China Lake, are we going to require them to do more testing or just that one data point? And these are from the 2022 investigative order.
They are doing more testing, installing more wells. George, for instance, is I believe we just approved their RI phase. Some of the RI phases are investigating a subset of the sites that were investigated. So there's priorities there. So the fire training facilities are some of the highest detections across all the military facilities, and that's a lot of where the focus has been in the fire training facilities. I don't have an exact number of wells that were installed for the phase one, but the military also is leveraging their existing well networks to sample as well. So there's a lot of additional sampling that has been taking place at all the facilities.
Okay, so do they provide that data to the water board as they take the samples, or do they wait and compile a report and provide that to you at some point in the future?
It comes to us in a report. Generally speaking, we would review the work plan, they'd carry out the work plan, the sampling, and then we'd get a report. In some instances, we may discuss some of the preliminary results. So a lot of the investigations have been a collaborative effort. So they'll collect a round of samples from existing wells. They'll present that data, that preliminary data, and use that data to inform where additional monitoring wells need to be informed. So all that data is compiled into a final report, but we may get previews of that report as the investigations happen.
Okay, thank you.
Hmm?
No questions from me, but a big appreciation and thank you to both our staff and state board staff. It's a tough issue and complicated, and you helped us out a lot with that.
I do have one question.
Oh, you do? Okay. Go ahead, Board Member Pearson.
I had to go look up my question. I'm surprised Bishop Airport wasn't included. Because I looked it up. It has twice as many aircraft landing per year, almost twice as many. It has longer airstrips. It has a huge military history there, starting World War II through the 80s. Who knows what's been dumped out there? And Mammoth is a relatively small airport compared to Bishop. Just curious how all that all came about.
I believe the initial investigative orders came out of registration for the AFFF systems from the FAA. So I don't know if they just didn't have a system or they had a different foam that didn't contain PFAS, but there was a process in that.
Could I ask the same question about Truckee Airport? Same answer.
I believe so. We can look into it and get back to you.
Yeah, curious because Truckee Airport has got a lot of activity and they also have all the firefighting services do both their training and their work out of there for all the fires in our region because it's where Cal Fire has its plane and helicopters and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I appreciate it. A little follow up there.
Okay.
Anything else, no. Board members? Public on this one? It's not a hearing, but I don't see any. All right, great. Thank you so much. I'm going to close that item. Board members, do we need a quick break, or could we go on to item 7? We get through. You're fine? You're good? Okay. All right, so item 7, which is our last one. Before we do this, in case I forget, I'm going to remind the public or anyone interested or watching that we will be back here. It's not a continuation, but another regular meeting. I guess it's a separate meeting, but it's a continuation of the meeting. That was redundant. 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. So we'll be back again for some additional items tomorrow and look forward to that. And with that, Executive Officer's Report, Ben Lenton.
All right, good afternoon, members of the board, Board Chair Lux. My name is Ben Lutton. I'm the executive officer here at Lahontan. I'll be giving you the executive officer's report, item 7. To start off, I want to announce a win, a celebration, and that is we were recently approved for a reorg of our staff. These changes will be better align staffing program functions across the region by redistributing positions to units where they more naturally align and consolidating our administrative support under a single supervisor and improving reporting relationships to reflect actual operational responsibilities. So we were looking at addressing staffing imbalances in our land disposal unit and the surface water and cannabis unit, formally align analytical support for the Leviathan Mine Cleanup Project with the technical unit it primarily serves, and centralize our administrative support by eliminating the Victorville admin unit and consolidating staff under one administrative unit. So when we do have the org chart to support all those changes, we'll be providing you with all that. Other personnel updates, vacancies. We have a water resource control engineer vacancy in the cannabis unit. New hire will start on May 12th. We have a couple of administrative positions, one in South Lake Tahoe. New hire will start on May 4th, which I guess was a couple days ago. And also in Victorville, a new administrative support will start on May 11th. We also have an engineering geologist position in our DOD unit. The job posted on April 23rd, and the final filing date is in May 13th. We also have an environmental scientist in our dredge and forestry unit. The position has closed, and we're recruiting right now. Environmental scientist in the non-point source unit. The job posting is closed, and the hiring manager is looking at applications, and then our regional administrative officer that was formerly held by Eric Shea, job posted on April 22nd and has a filing date on May 12th. So a lot of vacancies. I anticipate the next time I see you guys in August, I'll have a lot of announcements for new hires and names to go with all those positions. So this executive officer report covers the months of February and March 2026. February report starts on Bait Stamp 5-7 in your board packet and includes one article, which is titled Focus Feasibility Study for the Leviathan Mine Superfund Site. That's written by Hannah Bartholomew and Abby Kezier. Also in that February report, we have the fourth quarter of 2025 violations and unauthorized discharge report and other enforcement actions put together by our enforcement coordinator, Shelby Barker. And I'm going to pause right now and see if Shelby can join us on the Zoom platform. I think she was a little bit under the weather recently, so she's Zooming in.
I'm here. Did you want me to speak to the violations now?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Lux and fellow board members. I apologize, I'm not there. Got a virus and pneumonia. So my name is Shelby Barker. I'm a senior engineering geologist and the enforcement coordinator for our region. The fourth quarter 2025 violations and unauthorized discharge report is available in your packet beginning Bait Stamps 7-8. And during this quarter, there were 71 violations. Of those violations, 46 were issued by the State Water Resource Control Board for industrial general permit enrollees who had failed to recertify their no exposure certification for the 2025 and 2026 reporting year. State Board issued a notice of violation to each of these enrollees. Details for each of these 71 violations are provided in the table shown in Bait Stamp 7-9 through 7-15, including the remainder of the violations from those that were reported with the from State Board with the enrollees. During this reporting quarter, there was one sanitary sewer overflow of 8,862 gallons that occurred during a heavy rain event. The release was cleaned up and the discharger has been evaluating options to upgrade the system. There were also three unauthorized discharges that occurred at unregulated facilities. And the respective responsible parties for each of these instances, including the sanitary sewer overflow, have reported completion of cleanup activities. no further action has been required. During this reporting period, there was no formal enforcement that was finalized. And so that concludes the update for that violations and discharge report and enforcement activities.
Board Chair, I would just suggest maybe taking any comments or questions for Shelby now.
Yep. Board Member
Deaver. Hey, Shelby, it's Rick Deaver. On date stamp 713, I noticed Victorville Wastewater Treatment Plant had a spill.
Yes.
It says out of a gravity mainline. I'd like to have the report sent to me that they submitted and the results of the CCTV and how they calculated 8,862 gallons out of a gravity mainline during a storm event, if you could.
Yes, and I believe the caseworker on this, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's Sergio Alonso who is present. So I will work with him and we will get you that information.
I see somebody from Victorville, but they probably don't want to come up. I think. All right, thank you, Shelby.
Other board members? Other? No? No? Thank you so much, Shelby. Go ahead, man.
All right. So next we have the March portion of the ER report. It starts on date stamp 7-23 in your board packet. The number of good articles in the March report. First, an article by Anna Garcia, Owens Valley Groundwater Authority Board Meeting. Next, we had an article titled Indian Creek Reservoir Faces Challenges in Meeting TMDL Targets by Eli Balderas. Very, very nicely done there. And then one of the standing items came to you, written by Mo Loden and Danny McClure, vision plan implementation for both the Bishop and West Fort Carson vision plans. And I really encourage you to check out table 4.1, the West Fort Carson vision plan implementation summary. It's just a really nice table, I believe Danny put together, that shows implementation schedule and provides updates. Couple more things before I close here, and then I'll take comments or questions. As State Board Member Nicole Morgan, our liaison to State Board, mentioned, WQCC will be next week in Sacramento. Jeff and I plan on attending in person. I believe a couple other board members here will try to attend remotely. So the prompt for this year's updates from the regions is regions 2 to 3 biggest accomplishments during the Newsom administration. So that would go back 8 years-ish, which happens to coincide when I joined Lahontan around 2018. So it was easy for me to do the math in terms of timeline and how long ago that was. But the three topics we're going to go over, just as a preview, is I'm going to talk about our regional harmful algal bloom program, which got underway starting in about 2021. There was some legislation before that, which got the funding for it, but that was when we really got started in earnest. And that's in Mary Wagner's division. And then I'm also going to talk about PG&E Hinkley with major progress achieved with the release of the background study regarding the naturally occurring Chrome 6 in 2023. And that, you know, PG&E has met some pretty significant cleanup goals that were announced in 2025. So a lot of history with that site, some pretty major accomplishments in the last 8 years. And then I'm going to talk about our enforcement program, which has undergone a lot of improvements, especially in the past 4 to 5 years. And so that will be the third topic that I go over. So we have 6 to 8 minutes to talk about all three of those topics, so I'll be challenged to keep it brief. Couple more things. We've talked about all of our organizational improvements here many times, and part of that was the creation of what we call the 4R day. We do that with our staff about once a quarter, which is half a day meeting dedicated to evaluating our workload and reprioritizing, as well as connecting with each other and continuing to build on a strong organizational culture. And the 4Rs stand for reflection, recalibration, release, and results. So what was unique about the 4R day we had a couple weeks ago was that Region 3 Central Coast joined us, their management team, because they were curious about it and had heard a lot about it, a lot of the successes that we've achieved through it. So I want to thank Assistant Executive Officer Jan Zimmerman, because she did a lot of the legwork inviting and coordinating with Region 3. And then they also attended one of our managers' meetings last week. So it was really cool. I mean, we got a chance to celebrate and explain the process. It was a great growth opportunity for our management team to be able to describe how it all works and a lot of the efficiencies that we've gained through it. So I just wanted to, again, thank Jan, thank all of our management team, and really let you know about that coordination that we've been doing with Central Coast. And then also part of the 4R day, we did an exercise with staff around accomplishments from the fiscal year that we're currently in, so the fiscal year for 2025 and 2026, and then asked them about what they think our priorities should be for the coming fiscal year in 2026-27. And we did this last year, a group activity as part of the 4R day. And I just want to share with you a couple themes that came out of it. And this will be a preview to what we cover during the accomplishments and priorities item in August. So in terms of accomplishments that staff feel really proud of, what we were able to achieve this last fiscal year, which actually technically ends at the end of June. And again, these are just themes. So major advancements in our projects to address water quality, number one. Number two, strengthening program systems and documentation. Number three, team building, hiring, and workforce development. Number four, community engagement, partnerships, and collaboration. And number five, internal operations and office beautification and improvements. And then looking forward to priorities, theme number one, advancing major environmental and regulatory projects. Theme number two, strengthening teams through hiring, onboarding, and training. Number three, improving program structure, workflows, and consistency. Number four, expanding fieldwork, monitoring, and technical capacity. And number five, collaboration, relationship building, and external engagement. So a lot of similarities between the two years, but there's some differences there too. So another great round of input from staff, we thought. And with that, that concludes my report. So I'll entertain any questions.
Okay, board questions. Let's start with Board Member Cox.
Thank you. I always appreciate these presentations, Ben. You had mentioned at the start of your presentation that a reorganization was recently approved. Is this a result of leadership's efforts to recalibrate the workload as well as the input from staff during the 3R days? I mean, what brought about this reorganization? And then lastly, when will the board be able to see that?
Yeah, so if you go back in time a couple of years, you recall that we were in a pretty dire situation with the state budget, and there were a number of budget reduction drills that we had to do, including a number of vacancy sweeps. And I may have mentioned it at that time, but we had to make some hard choices about which positions that we were going to be giving up. And I decided to do a more program-focused and so there were a couple of cannabis program positions at the time that we had to give up. Well, we ended up getting those back, long story short, as well as receiving some positions for the Sackett decision. So that's one element of it. We have some new incoming positions, four or more. At the same time, as a part of the 4R day, as you alluded to, and in discussions with our management team, we've been kicking around the idea of adding another unit to the Victorville division because it was just becoming too big, under three units. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Christine Guerra's unit in particular, land disposal, I think was up to seven or eight staff. So we wanted to rebalance as well. And so the timing was about right. Our last reorg was in 2019. I kind of led the effort at the time with former AEO Doug Smith. So it was a combination of getting positions back, you know, talking with management and trying to rebalance numbers in Victorville. And frankly, this is all sort of strategic towards perhaps having two divisions in the Victorville office and then theoretically being able to obtain another executive position.
Thank you.
Board Member Pierce?
No questions, but thanks, Ben. Great information.
Board Member Deaver?
No questions.
Ben, not so much a question, but just a thank you. I love the EO reports. They're great for me. I really enjoy them. So I echo Board Member Cox's kudos on that. And then also kudos to Dan McClure on this this table you pointed out for the West Fork Carson. I really like this kind of a summary. And I know we get a lot of these in different forms and different formats, but this kind of thing, these kind of milestones and accomplishments, it really helps. We have a thick packet, and you can go right to those kind of Excel charts. So thank you for whoever worked on that, including Dan McClure. Okay. Thanks, Ben. So item 8 is closed session, and my understanding is we do not have a closed session this afternoon. Is that correct? That is correct. Okay. So that's it for us. Again, we'll be back here at 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, ready to do it again and jump in. And there will be public forum and all the same stuff tomorrow morning with some new content items. And we look forward to seeing that. And with that, we will close the meeting.